Hey, it's Lisa Z from RCP with Jim and Laura here. We want to warn our listeners that the topics we're discussing today are very important to all of us, but they may be upsetting to some people. And if you or someone you know is experiencing thoughts of depression or self-harm, please stop right now and call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. The line is available 24/7. It is free and completely confidential. Laura?
And in the UK, you can call Hopeline, which is for the prevention of young suicide, on 0800 068 4141. Or the Samaritans can be contacted on 116 123. Childline on 0800 1111. And if you're in Australia, there's the Crisis Support Service Lifeline, which is 131114. So what we're going to talk about, people may find triggering. And so it's important that you know what help is out there. And also, please do use your self-care tools as well. But we think it's really important to have this conversation, which is why we're going to be talking about key themes coming out of 13 Reasons Why.
And in addition to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline in the United States, you can call the Suicide Crisis Line at 1-800-784-2433.
Can a dramatic depiction of suicide go too far? A new series on Netflix about a teenage girl's tragic death has some school districts and mental health experts worried that the show has gone beyond just entertainment and could pose a threat to young students.
Among the concerns cited is the very explicit way Hannah's suicide is shown in the final episode. Some psychologists say it glorifies suicide. Others worry it could lead to copycat behavior. The National Association of School Psychologists advised teenagers who suffer from suicidal thoughts not to watch at all, saying it may lead impressionable viewers to romanticize the choices made by the characters.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today from London is
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, and founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I am Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jim Clementi is my colleague.
And today we have a very special guest in our studio.
Hi, I'm Cheryl Eskin. I'm the program director of Teen Line.
Great. Can you tell us a little bit about what Teen Line is?
So Teen Line is a service for teens by teens. We are a helpline that teens can call, text, or email about anything they're dealing with in their lives, from suicide to child abuse to relationships, bullying, anything and all in between. We've been around for 38 years, founded on the premise that when teens are struggling, they turn to each other rather than to the adults in their lives. So that's our platform that we've expanded to the point with the internet that we're international at this point. So we hear from teens all over the country, the U.S., all over the world as well. And as I was saying earlier, we've really found that teen angst is teen angst is teen angst, no matter where you live. Some of the issues are very similar. And we also do a lot of outreach to the community, just decreasing stigma around mental health and prevention. So I'm excited to be here today.
Great.
Share.
Why don't we start out right away by telling us how do they get in touch with your teen hotline?
Yes. So if you want to get in touch with us, we are in the U.S., so you can reach us. We're open every night, 6 to 10 p.m. California time or Pacific Standard Time. Our phone number is 310-855-4673. Or you can text TEEN, the keyword, to 839-863. You can also, for our international people, you can visit our website, which is TeenLineOnline, all one word, teenlineonline.org. And there you can email us, join our message boards, or if the time change works in your favor, call or text us as well.
That's great. Thanks.
Good to have you on, Cheryl. I have a question for you just in terms of sort of volume of calls or texts that you get and which medium do teenagers tend to prefer? Does it tend to be more text related or call or emails?
We definitely have seen, we get about 18,000 contacts a year, which is pretty amazing because we're only open 4 hours a night because we are staffed by teens. People always ask, why aren't you 24/7? It's because we're staffed by teens who obviously need to go to school, need to go to sleep. But we, after hours, roll over to the National Suicide Prevention Line. So 24/7, you will get someone. You're not going to always get a teen. But in terms of what we've seen the last couple of years, text is really where teens are reaching out. Our text volume has really gone up. Email as well, because that seems to be the most preferred medium.
That's great.
Well, Cheryl, I reached out to you because I knew that Jim, Laura, and I were going to be covering the Netflix series 13 Reasons Why. And I thought it was important at some point to get on another mental health professional who's really on the ground and in the trenches day in and day out with this subject. And also to get your reaction to the series. I know there has been a lot of controversy, both in favor and critically. Tell us about when you first heard about the series and what your journey has been in watching the series.
Okay, loaded question. Mm-hmm. I was going to say, the series, I work obviously with teens. We have a staff of about 120 teens. So I think it was the teens who first brought it to our attention. People binge watching it pretty much the first day or two that it was out. And I think I watched it probably in the first week or so it was out, not necessarily the binge watching, but I did see it. And it's definitely been a long journey. It's definitely, I will say, it's opened a conversation. Mm-hmm. I think people are talking about suicide in a way that they never were before. And for that, I think it's amazing. I, along with a lot of other mental health professionals and suicide prevention organizations, have been concerned they haven't done it in the most responsible way, that there's a lot of things in the series that are not recommended in the series. And I do think from talking to teens and other people, it's been very, very triggering for a lot of people, the series.
Well, we at Real Crime Profile would like to do responsible coverage of this series. So we're very glad that you're here to help us sort of shape our message, because this is an incredibly important thing to us. It's incredibly important that we are preventing suicide as opposed to glamorizing it in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what, I mean, I think the series, from what I've heard, was very true to teen life in a lot of ways. The concerns that we have is resources weren't provided. They are now. If you go back at the beginning of four of the episodes start off with trigger warnings, and they've made that resource page. That wasn't there when the show first aired. There were a lot of teens watching it with no resources given. And we know that when media covers suicide, it needs to be done in a way that there's hope, that there's resources given, that there's trigger warnings. I heard from a lot of teens who've struggled with suicidality or other things that this show was incredibly, incredibly triggering for them to watch.
Well, in that light, can we please do that right now and give a trigger warning? And we'll use this at the beginning of every episode before we start talking about 13 Reasons Why.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I would definitely say to anyone who's watching or listening that if you are struggling, you're not alone. There's help out there. There's hope. I think that's the biggest problem we have, is that people think that they're alone. They're ashamed. They don't want to reach out. They're fear of being judged, stigmatized, criminalized, whatever word you want to use. But there is hope out there. There are people. If you're a teen, you can reach out to us. If you're following, Logic released a song recently, which is the National Suicide Prevention Number, which is 1-800-273-8255. Mm. And that's been amazing. Calls to Suicide Prevention Line have spiked like no time in their history. Because people, and if you've listened to the song, I think, I want to die. It's the perspective of someone calling a suicide hotline. And then by the end of the call, the person is transformed to, I might want to live. Mm-hmm. And so that's been amazing. So I think the message of today is to reach out if you're struggling, that there are people out there who will listen and will, help you.
I think one of the things that I do admire about the series is that no matter who you are, it covers a perspective that you can relate to. You may not be having suicidal thoughts, but you might be a friend, or you might be. It just covers just the gamut of the teenage experience, which, right, I thought was very powerful, and that everybody has a backstory and everybody can be misunderstood and things like that. So, but what are the other criticisms that you have in some of the depictions? So let's say that it always had a disclaimer before and after, and there was, always a resource shown. What are the other things that you have trouble with the series?
I think a lot of it, I mean, it's TV, so I think a lot of it was gratuitous. I don't think, and this is, you know, for those of you who haven't watched the show, this is a spoiler alert, but I think most people know at this point, at the end, there is a scene where they do show her taking her life. Mm-hmm. And I think every person involved in suicide prevention or every research study will say, you don't do that. You don't show it. You don't talk about methods.
It's not
responsible. It's not responsible. It's a scene that's about 2 or 3 minutes. It's really hard to watch.
It's incredibly hard to watch. Yeah. I started gagging, actually.
Yes.
I couldn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was really hard.
It's really hard, and there's no need for it. The book actually is, you know, it's based on a book. The book is vague about what she does. And I think that's a better way of doing it. There was no, it felt gratuitous. It just felt like it wasn't necessary. It was incredibly triggering. And I know a lot of people who couldn't watch it or were so disturbed by it. So I think it's irresponsible personally that it's still in there.
Yeah.
I think it could be left to the imagination. And I think they were going for the effect of what suicide has. But I think there's other ways of doing it without showing that scene. It also kind of is like a how-to in a lot of ways.
Right.
When you have a young teen who sees this, it's like, oh, okay, well, you know, this is my guide.
Right. And why didn't they have a responsible consultant who would have told them exactly that same thing? Why didn't they use that? I mean,
they did, but they had many doctors who helped them through the whole thing. Well, if you watch Beyond the Reasons, you know, they do talk about, and I'm not arguing, you know, one way or the other, please, you know, it's all in the eye of the beholder. But when they talk about why they showed that scene, they articulate it very well.
Yeah, but articulating well and being responsible are two very different things.
And they had not just one, but several doctors involved in this. So,
right, but did they listen or didn't they listen?
No,
they were involved
and throughout the whole process.
Yeah,
and they defend them. If you watch Beyond the Reasons, you know, they defend showing that. Now, I have more of a problem with the other scenes where they show her in Clay's imagination is how she had died. That I felt was kind of ridiculous to show. But yeah, they took this scene head on and, you know, was their choice.
Just because it was a choice doesn't make it the right choice. Apparently, it was a very wrong choice. Am I right?
That's my feeling. And there also has been criticism that, yes, they did reach out to people, but they didn't necessarily reach out to people in the suicide prevention world.
Oh.
It's kind of like reaching out to a general practitioner instead of a cardiologist when it's a heart issue.
Right.
Because there are people who specialize in suicide prevention. There's a whole organization, American Association of Suicidology, and that's been the criticism that they reached out to people, maybe not the right people.
Right.
And after the fact, there have been people involved who are very involved in, you know, suicide prevention work. And I think that's part of the reason why there's some of the trigger warnings, why they've developed the hotlines.
Right. So it seems like after the fact, they've tried to sort of repair maybe some of the damage that might have been done by just putting it out there irresponsibly and not actually taking into account how this might affect teens who are going through some pretty tough things.
Right.
And so was there an increase, Cheryl, in calls or text messages or emails to the helpline? And do we know whether there was an increase in suicides?
We've heard it. We definitely, us, and I know we work closely with Dee Hirsch Suicide Prevention Line, which is part of the national hotline. We definitely started tracking our calls that we got in response to 13 Reasons Why, and we definitely saw an upsurge. There also have been suicide prevention organizations tracking attempts made and completions after the show, and there have been a number. I mean, if you Google it, you can see news stories where people blame their child's death on 13 Reasons Why and things of that sort. I don't think suicide is as easy as saying 13 Reasons Why caused my child to, you know, take their life. I think there's a lot that goes into it, but I do think it's a precipitating factor. I do think seeing that scene to a teen who's doing okay, I think seeing that scene might be upset and, you know, hopefully reach out, talk about it. A teen who's already struggling, seeing that scene is just, it's a how-to guide and it's just damaging. And
I mean, I think it was a very graphic scene, absolutely. And, you know, I have to say, it was very powerful. You know, watching 13 Reasons Why, it really resonated and it's something I kept going back to. You know, every training session I ran, I brought it into the conversation. And so some of the devices they used, I actually think had a very powerful impact, albeit I agree about doing things, you know, to not romanticize or not sensationalize is really important. But for me, it did really resonate. And, you know, I know certainly whenever I talk out on a program and, you know, I did ITV last week and we had a phone in of lots of people calling in who have been stalked and I was giving advice to them. You know, our helpline here at Paladin, we had this huge spike in people calling up. So any kind of, you know, done in a sensible way, you obviously do get people disclosing more and you hope that you help more than certainly you trigger. You know, right. It's always the challenge, isn't it?
Definitely. And I think one of my other criticisms of the show is they depict the adults in there as really inept. Like there's no, she goes to the school counselor at the end and he basically tells her to shrug it off or just move on with the assault and isn't there as a reason. I mean, she dropped as a therapist, she dropped so many clues that she was struggling or suicidal and he just completely missed the boat. And that's my feeling of all the adults and all the friends in her life too, that, you know, people saw what was going on and didn't really do anything. So that's, I also think, the damage. There's no hope in there.
Right. And I know I reached out to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline before we started this coverage and to find out what ways we can help prevent suicide. And that's also something that the kind of recommendations that they made were to make sure that we let people who are suffering like that with depression, when they're feeling alone, they're not actually alone. Mm-hmm. They don't have to be isolated. There are many organizations out there like your Teen Line and like the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline that can help you feel like you are going to feel better, like there isn't a lack of hope. And one of the ways you do it is by taking baby steps. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's overwhelming when you think about everything that could be going wrong in your life. But if you take it step by step, bit by bit, choice by choice, that you can actually start moving in the right direction. And with that movement, the light starts shining and you start feeling a little better. And the more you can do, just little things, surround yourself with people who support you, avoid the situations where there are people who don't and the negative things in your life, but also do things good for yourself. And some of that is exercising and eating right and thinking positively, taking the affirmative step to think, all right, I'm going to try to visualize making something better, and then that'll be the first step to making it happen.
Brian Yorkey is one of the show's creators.
We did want it to be painful to watch because we wanted it to be very clear that there is nothing in any way worthwhile about suicide.
I want to ask you about your comment about the adults in Hannah's life being, you know, inept and such. So what should they have done? I mean, how should they have been depicted if they seemed, you know, to be... I saw a depiction of adults trying to figure out what to do with their kids who had a friend who killed themselves and how to deal, like, how much should I helicopter my child or how much should I give them space? And so... what should parents do when this happens to a friend of their child?
Right. Well, I think, I mean, the biggest criticism for me was with the counselor because he
should have known better, obviously,
in that role. Mm-hmm. I think in general, we do a lot of this is educating parents to talk to their kids about suicide at a young age, talk about things like mental health and depression. I think that's what the show doesn't do. Hannah, to me, was depressed. And we know statistically 90% of people who die by suicide have a diagnosable mental illness. Right. So that's never addressed in the show. Even Clay's parents, there's some intimation that he took meds at some point before and they want to, you know, him to start taking meds again. But there's never a mention of really why he took the meds, of what was going on, an open dialogue. And I think that's what's missing in a lot of ways of just parents being there as a listening resource or having the tools to even say, hey, you seem really down lately. Is there, you know... what's going on of just being that listening ear, if that made sense.
No, that makes sense, but I am trying to, like, I believe me, I'm not trying to get into any kind of conflict with you, but I'm just trying to honestly ask a question because I see episodes where they do say, is everything okay?
Right.
And it's almost like, that's like the wrong thing to say.
Right.
So I did see depictions of parents checking in.
Right.
How are you doing? How are you feeling? Is there anything you want to tell me?
Right.
So that's why, is there something more? What more is there?
Right.
What is the script
right.
that we should say?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I mean, one of the things, and I will answer your question kind of a roundabout way, all these posters go up after Hannah dies by suicide. And I think the idea is before and post, you know, prevention instead of postvention. A lot of schools, a lot of places, it's after the fact. And I think there's a new California law, at least, that requires 7th through 12th grade schools to have a plan in place for dealing with suicide prevention as well. And it recommends involving parents. And I think that's a huge piece of educating parents that we know, you know, suicide is the second leading cause of death among 10 to 24-year-olds. It's not on most parents' radar. We worry about car seats, we worry about sunscreen, we worry about all those sorts of things. So that's probably a bigger issue, but I think that's what the parents were missing in a lot of ways, of an awareness that this could be my kid. Let's talk about suicide, let's talk about depression, let's, you know, as Jim was saying, some coping skills of, you know, what can we do to get you through this? Even mentioning the word suicide or depression or not letting it go so much, if that makes sense, which is hard. As a parent of a teen, teens push you away. So
yeah.
They're fighting a dance as well.
You know, here the advice would be, and certainly when we talk to clients as well, we would be quite specific about suicide and asking the direct question.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the directness and, you know, being specific rather than you're not thinking of doing something silly or, to yourself, or even just how are you, you know, a general check-in. I think we have to name it, and
mm-hmm.
it's the silence that can collude. And that can be the biggest killer, can't it, when it's not being specific or direct. And it certainly seems the research and just how we train our staff, because we're a trauma-informed service, that it's important not to dance around it or dress it up as something and be so vague that you're not actually opening the conversation about what it is and what's happening for someone.
Right, totally. And that's what we say is the biggest, you know, thing is, if you're worried about something, ask them directly. You know, that doesn't put an idea in someone's head to ask if they're suicidal, to ask if they're struggling.
So it doesn't.
It doesn't.
So I think that's a myth, right?
Would you agree, Cheryl, that not asking is too great a risk to take? I mean,
yeah,
I feel that strongly. You know, you could save someone's life by being very specific that could be missed. You know, in Hannah's case, it was missed so many times, like you said. But sometimes, you know, we call it the one chance rule. You get the one chance to ask the right question, and you've got to be specific.
Right. I agree 100%. I think a lot of people think if you ask someone if they're thinking about hurting themselves or killing themselves, it's going to put the idea in their head.
Right.
And we just don't work that way. It's right. not like I say that to you, Lisa, and you're like, oh, gee, great idea, Cheryl. Thanks. Usually you say that to a person when you've noticed enough things.
Right.
And there's a reason to ask. And it's usually a relief that someone's noticed, is willing to have
right.
that dark
Naming
conversation.
Their emotions
right.
is a very effective mm-hmm. thing. And so when teens do try to push parents away, the parents can overcome that
right.
by actually being supportive and direct. You are not alone. Mm-hmm. You obviously seem depressed right. to me. You seem like you feel like you're isolated.
Right.
You're not isolated. I'm here for you. I'm here with you, and we can actually do things together. I'm here to support you. I will help you. I will get you to somebody who can help you if you don't want me to do it. There are plenty of resources available. Saying those very specific, direct things and not dancing around. Because if you're leery about talking to your child about suicide, your child is going to pick up on that nonverbal. They're going to pick up on it, and they're going to be leery about talking to you. If you're open and relaxed and supportive in a loving way, then that will actually encourage them to talk to you. And that's an important thing on any topic, mm-hmm. but on this one, which is life critical.
Yeah, 100%. You said it much more eloquently than I did. So thank you. I 100% agree with everything you said. And I think just know, yeah, that parents have their kids back. And they're not going to get in trouble. They're not going to get mad. A lot of times we know kids don't talk to their parents because they're afraid their parents are going to be overwhelmed with their big feelings.
Exactly.
And it's hard not to be. If your kid comes to you and says, I want to kill myself, it's hard not to be. But that's the time to, you know, be calm for your child and, you know, freak out to another adult in your life. But you need to be there for your child and
right.
be able to handle their big emotions and not get them in trouble or not, you know.
Yeah. And think of how much more severe the issue is after the child already commits suicide.
Right.
To parents who are out there, and if they have any inkling at all,
right.
the last thing you want to be is in a position after it happens
right.
to say, why didn't I do something?
Right.
Why didn't I know? Why didn't I educate myself enough to right. know what would help prevent this from happening?
Right.
Let's not let that happen anymore. Let's
no.
make sure that parents who see this, friends who see this, people in youth-serving organizations who are around children who are experiencing deep depression and mental issues that is driving them to try to hurt themselves, they should actually directly address it in a very calm, supporting, loving way, not in a fearful. The more fearful you are of talking about it, the more you will transmit to them, and the less likely you're going to have a conversation. You need to have open conversations back and forth with children and teenagers about these kinds of issues.
Right, 100%. And I think some of the warning signs, I mean, we should mention some of the warning signs of teens are honestly the biggest one is just a huge change in behavior mm-hmm. or appearance. And again, we go with baseline. You know, a kid who was always pretty isolated, who's isolated now, is not as worrisome as a kid who used to be really engaged, have a lot of friends, and now is spending all their time in their room. Or a kid who used to care about school all of a sudden has, you know, is getting bad grades or used to care about appearance and now is not showering, looking unkempt. Those are the things we need to look for. We also look for the things they may say about hating my life or wishing it was over, or a kid who's not making plans for the future. You know, maybe they're a senior in college, friends are applying. I mean, senior in high school, friends are applying to college or jobs. They're not even thinking that way. Also, substance abuse is one. It's hard to know if chicken or the egg. But another big one is teens don't really make wills, but they'll give away things.
Mm.
So that's something that we see. And as parents, sometimes it's trusting your gut, or even as educators or other adults, when something's off, that's generally a time to, like Jim was saying, to ask of,
right.
you know, I've noticed this about you. I'm really concerned.
And can I ask you two very, very important things that parents somehow need to get a handle on
right.
are social networking
mm-hmm.
and cell phones.
Yeah.
Because these are the ways that many children and teens communicate these
right.
these feelings and these issues and also show a change in behavior. How can parents get more involved so that they know what their kid is doing on social media? I mean,
right.
there's always new things that come up. I mean, Kick is the latest one I've heard about.
Right.
Oh, God. What's that?
There are thousands of things that
right.
that I probably don't know about.
Yeah, there's a lot. And I think it's starting young of having that open dialogue, like you said, with your kids, of that you're there for them as a resource if they get into a situation over their head. I think that's a lot of times kids don't turn to parents because they don't want to get in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe they did something, you know, they shouldn't have, for lack of a better word, and now they're worried they're going to get in trouble. But I think having that dialogue, letting them know that you have their back is an important thing. I don't think it's necessarily spying on your kid. Because you can't spy on everything. I mean, they're coming up with new apps and new tricky things
oh, yeah.
every day. But it's being able to have that trust in the relationship that they will come to you, that they know what's appropriate, that they have good boundaries online, and that you model it as well.
Right. But here's the thing. Okay. And I use this analogy a lot. If you know it's a danger to cross a street in front
right.
of your house because it's a busy street,
right.
what do? The parents tell the children about
right.
it. They walk to the corner. They say, you push this button. You wait for the crosswalk. You look both ways. You hold their hand and you do it until
right.
they can do it on their own. We need to do the same thing with social networking and the same thing with cell phones.
100%.
When they start, we have to give them good practices,
mm-hmm.
tell them the risks and dangers that are out there, and also engage them in a dialogue back and forth that actually creates an atmosphere in which they will feel good about sharing things that are happening, good and bad.
Right.
Otherwise, you're letting them into a black hole.
Right.
And they have no idea what the risks are or what the results could be, because cyberbullying can be a major trigger for these kinds of events, as well as just not being in a clique, not
right.
being accepted. And those
right.
little things to a teenager could feel catastrophic
right.
when in fact they're not.
Right.
Laura?
Yeah, I think the parents actually are very interesting characters in 13 Reasons Why. The burden that's left for them, I feel that they acted some of those scenes particularly well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that legacy, you know, that's left behind. And what 13 Reasons did well was, for me, it's showing two scripts all the time. you know, one through one person's eyes, and then you see it through Hannah's eyes. And obviously, you know, that's quite unique on this particular show. And so you can understand how things were, you know, misunderstood or misconstrued or seen from someone else's perspective. But I felt the agony of the parents was really palpable. I don't know how you felt about how they were cast and you know, their reality.
Yeah, I do agree with you. I think it was very real. And I think, and I'm never one who's going to blame the parents, and I'm not, that's not what I'm trying to do. But I think they did depict the reality of the parents were very busy with their own lives. They were worrying about their financial situation. They had a lot going on. And I think they, you know, Hannah knew how kids know what stresses their parents are under, and they don't always reach out because they don't want to add more to the plate. There was a scene where Hannah comes home after being assaulted and the parents were asleep on the couch. And I do believe had she woken the parents up, they would have been there for her. It would have been supportive. Mm-hmm. But I think she wasn't in that place of doing it because I think she knew how stressed they were, how much was going on. And so it's a complicated one. I think as parents, it's our role to keep a separate wall in some ways and, you know, be there for our kids, even if, you know, we have our own stuff going
on.
Yeah,
even in the tough times.
Yeah.
And she was trying to help them, wasn't she? I mean, that's kind of the irony as well, you know, that she feels their pressure and she's trying to help them, even though she's feeling really down. And, you know, I agree. You got this transitional moment that was really pregnant where she almost could have said something and then it doesn't happen and it could have changed. You know, I think one of the characters said it, it was a cumulative of so many different things, but if just one thing, you know, one conversation could have made all the difference. And that's why the focus on prevention and having that conversation and asking questions and being specific is just so important.
One thing is, I know Cheryl has children in school, and so do I, and I'm sure that you know that there's a huge campaign against bullying. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's something that is very present, all, you know, right in kindergarten all the way through is, you know, anti-bullying campaigns, which I think is great. And that's certainly depicted in 13 Reasons Why, all different kinds of bullying, cyberbullying to, you know, almost every character except for the bro jock, you know, is bullied. But we don't talk about what that bullying leads to suicide. That's something that we're hoping to avoid, you know, that if we nip the bullying in the bud, we won't get there. So it's much easier for us to talk about bullying with my kids than suicide. Mm-hmm. So how do you talk to a kid, you know, pre-suicidal thoughts? So
right.
If, you know, my kid is not suffering from any depression or any kind of behavioral changes, but I want to educate them about it, mm-hmm. What are the words you use?
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, I mean, I think bullying and suicide are definitely, it's not causation. I think that's a dangerous thing, that not every kid who's bullied goes on to kill themselves. And I think the media does that a lot of the time. And we know plenty of people who've been bullied who, you know, I mean, I think suicide's complex. It's not just one thing. It's not just the bullying. Maybe there was something else going on as well. But I think even more so than bullying prevention, I think we need to teach kindness. And we need to teach empathy. We need to teach friendship skills. And I think that's the stuff as parents we can do at home. And I think that's a big thing, that we never know what someone else is going through. And
I totally agree. I totally agree, Cheryl. Kindness and empathy and compassion.
Mm-hmm.
It's so important. And yet we miss all those beats and, you know, age appropriate stuff at school, parents, you know, and that's why I think 13 Reasons Why I did that kind of split. There's two sides to everything,
right?
And thoughts and feelings, they're not facts. They're things that are transient and they pass, you know, age appropriate meditation, how to, you know, not get overwhelmed. And what are some of the self-care things you can do, as well as people mentoring you and helping you?
Yeah. And I see a lot of parents who, you know, are not always the kindest either on social media or in person as well. So I think some of that is modeling for our kids the way we want them to be in the world, which isn't always easy. I mean, parents are not perfect. There's no such thing as a perfect parent. But I think that needs to be a focus as well as bullying.
Right. And I think, you know, you mentioned that parents can do this at home. But the problem is that some parents are overburdened. Some parents are immature. Some parents are not good people. And
right.
That doesn't mean that children.
Absent.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Completely absent.
Right. And so it doesn't mean that those children don't deserve to have wonderful lives. And so youth serving organizations, particularly schools, because they're mandated to be there, need to take on a piece of this responsibility and to catch the kids who are falling through the cracks, who don't have any support at home.
Right.
those are particularly vulnerable to kids, to a number of different vices and negative experiences. So it's the kind of thing where we have to be responsible enough to help the kids who don't have the support system that we were lucky enough to have.
Definitely. And that's where I think, and we could talk all about the evils of the internet and social media, what I think that it does really well, and I know this with your podcast as well, there are on our message boards or on online teen platforms, there's, you know, a gay kid in a rural town in Iowa who has no one to talk to, mm-hmm. who finds someone online mm-hmm. who's going through similar things, who can relate. And that's mm-hmm. probably the thing that keeps that kid maybe from becoming depressed or suicidal. Right. So I think there's a huge power to find like-minded people or people going through the same things, which can be a huge source of support. So you're not alone. I mean, that's the whole message of today, is there's always someone out there.
Right.
Talking of which, can I just give a reference to the UK and just to the Hope Line, which has a prevention of young suicide helpline. So Hope Line UK, which is 0800 068 4141, as well as Childline 0800 1111, and the Samaritans, which is 116 123.
That's great. I think that's so important for people to just know there's something out there and there's no judgment. I mean, I think one of our taglines is, it's okay if you're not okay, because I think there's a lot of pressure to be okay for all of us.
It's important for the viewers to see that there's often a lot of collateral damage when someone dies, and the person contemplating suicide might not realize how much their death will affect people that they love and that they didn't want to hurt.
A lot of times it feels like the things that you're experiencing aren't treatable, and that's why it can be overwhelming to try to explain it to someone, because you just feel like there's nothing you can do about it, but there usually is.
It's absolutely treatable. Anxiety is, depression is, talk therapy, treatment centers. There's a million ways that you can find help.
If someone watching this is feeling like their life doesn't have worth, I hope that you see around Hannah in this show all the people who care about her, and know that there are those people in your life as well.
It's a huge one. One of the things I did want to bring up of the show that isn't that realistic is, I mean, I believe Hannah was depressed. Depressed people don't usually write out tapes or don't have the energy to do the things that Hannah did. So I think that sometimes is a disservice as well, or like a glamorization. I don't even know what the right word is, but it's not so accurate.
Well, I think that was, if I may speak for all the writers, I think that was a device. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Does the book use that premise that it's that she makes tapes?
Yeah. I mean, okay. No, different. But
so I think from a dramatic point of view, when somebody kills themselves, you think, well, what were they thinking? Mm-hmm. And so this is what she was thinking. It's a way to know what was in her mind.
Right.
And sometimes what she says is accurate, and sometimes it's misguided.
Right.
Her point of view is not always trustworthy. But I think that was the device of, how do you get inside somebody's inner monologue? So, it may not be, that may have never, ever, ever happened in the history of teenagehood, but this is the way they wanted to show that. And I thought it was kind of an ingenious structure, from that point of view. I did want to mention that one of the doctors who did work on the script with the writers is Dr. Rona Hugh, and she is a professor at Stanford University. She's a medical director of acute psychiatric inpatient unit at Stanford Hospital. She specializes in the care of those with serious mental illnesses, including schizophrenia, bipolar, and depression, and she's received national recognition for her clinical care, research, and teaching. So just, that there was somebody, and I know she was one of a few people who consulted and helped with the script and the depiction.
But I think everything, I think it's going to be very hard to find something that supports that scene was okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was definitely a shocking scene, and
I couldn't watch it. I didn't watch it.
Yeah,
I mean, I deliberately did not watch it, because I do not think it is a good thing to do that. And everything that I've learned about this is that is not helpful and can actually promote it, mm-hmm. which is very unfortunate. Can we also talk about the after effects of suicide? To me, one of the issues is the ripple effect of mm-hmm. pain that flows from suicide.
Right.
It seems to me that people who are left in the aftermath of somebody who dies by suicide always experience pain and suffering mm-hmm. and loss.
Right.
And I don't know if that's intentional on part of the people who die by suicide, but it is a real fact.
Right.
And most of the time, the issues that drove a person to die by suicide could be resolved. And if those people around them were aware of what was actually going on in their mind, they would have made an effort mm-hmm. to try to stop it. And it's just a very unfortunate thing that at that point, it's impossible to stop.
Right. And I think the hard part, I'm going to speak specifically about teens, but I think teens don't have the life experience to know that it's going to get better. Their first breakup or their first fight or their first this is the end of the world because they don't know it will get better. Mm. And I think that's where we as adults, parents, schools can teach coping skills, can teach things like mindfulness or relaxation or exercise, whatever it is, or to even talk about these tough feelings. Mm. Those that are not left on their own to fester in them. But we do know, I mean, most people who die by suicide, I don't think really want to die. They want a way out of the pain.
Mm.
And that's what we need to help them find a way out of the pain in living as
yeah.
well.
As yeah, they, because it can get better. It will get better
right.
if they address this, if they do reach out for help, if
right.
they do go to the many professionals who are trained to right. actually address these topics directly.
Yeah, and that's where I think, you know, that like I said, 90% of people who die by suicide have a diagnosable mental illness. That doesn't mean they were diagnosed, but we do know there's a lot of treatments for depression. There's treatments for anxiety, PTSD, a lot of things. And I, again, to go back to what I think the show could have done better is maybe give some hope. And I realize it was plot device. I realize all of that. But some of the kids who were struggling, maybe seeing someone actually go to a therapist or get help or go on meds or, you know, feel better. I think that's, I'm hoping maybe the second season has some messages of mm-hmm. hope that it can, because this was just a very dismal view. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right. I mean, one of the things that strikes me, you know, after someone dies by anything, but particularly suicide, there's a tendency to glamorize them or, you know, the memorials that spring up. I mean, there's a scene I remember where people had left flowers for Hannah mm-hmm. and the mom is at the school picking up the bouquet or whatever she's doing. And so, you know, the girl says to her, oh, look at all the flowers. Look how much people loved her. And she says something. I'm not going to get the flowers right. But anyone who knew Hannah knew she hated white roses or
right.
whatever it was.
So she cuts through that bullshit. And
yeah.
I thought that was a very
yes.
frank thing
mm-hmm.
to address.
Yes.
You know, that what
don't. They don't know her.
Yeah, exactly.
They didn't know her. They know her because she died by suicide and now right. they want to be a part of it. And, you know, that's, I think, the risk also that when someone dies by suicide, all of a sudden makes them, I don't want to say popular, but glamorized.
Yeah,
and that other kid who feels, you know, isolated thinks, if I do this, people are now going to care about me. And I think that's the scary.
But it's not real. That's so fake. That's not exactly what happens. And the fact is that if they really cared about her, they would have done something
right.
in her life.
Right.
Not in her death.
Right. And I think they didn't know. I mean, that's part of our message. We
right.
go to schools encouraging kids to be the voice of their friends. It's a great campaign in the UK, Protect Your Mates. It's a great campaign.
I wouldn't mind us talking a little bit about just, you know, all the other things that were going on that we hear, you know, from teenagers. And, you know, I think in terms of the portrayal, of course, in this 13 Reasons Why, we hear about cyberbullying, but also about stalking and domestic abuse and child abuse and sexual abuse. You know, these are all very difficult things that actually, you know, as we always talk about on Real Crime Profile, they are commonplace, you know, much more prevalent, particularly in schools and universities. And so I would expect that you hear a lot about that at the helpline. And so one question is about that and prevalence, and the other is also just about, I'm curious about what your teens who run the helplines, which I think is ingenious actually, what training they have to be able to deal with these very difficult issues that they'll be hearing about.
Yeah, so our teens are before they even become a part of their program, our program, they do an application, they come in for an interview, and then they go through a 65-hour training program, of which they can't miss any of the trainings. And because obviously if you miss the day where you learned about sexual assault, how are you going to take a sexual assault call? After they finish their 65-hour training, they come into the hotline
and observe there. And they also complete role plays, which are, you know, mock calls on different topics. So they spend about, I would say, probably 6 months to a year in training before they're actually taking phone calls, because this stuff is hard. It's a lot what they deal with. And I think they do it. I'm a licensed therapist myself. I will tell you, there's some teens who say things that I wish I could say in my practice. They're brilliant. They do. Mm-hmm. They get it. They talk in a way that, you know, us as adults can't. But I think we do, responsibly, we do want them to have that training, to have that background, to feel secure in what they're doing. And that's why we put so much energy and effort into them. We also have adult volunteers with them every night who don't get on the phones, but they're there as a resource. Because obviously, yeah, they may take a call that someone who is sexually assaulted, and it could be really hard for them. So we want them to debrief and go home feeling okay.
Right. And so do you think the kind of depiction of the accumulation of all these things that happened to Hannah is realistic? You know, of course, there is the social media end, and that you get this sense that it never ends. You know, wherever you are, you go home, everyone's glued to their phones. You know, it's not just younger people. You walk down any street in London in commuter time and everyone's just looking down at their phones and not in the real world. But for them, it is the real world in many senses. I mean, did you get the sense that that's realistically depicted in terms of all the things that were happening around her and to her?
Yeah, I think it was. I heard from some teens it was really realistic, and it was like being in their high school, and it was unbelievable how well they did that. I heard from some teens, no, it wasn't their experience.
I think so, it depends on where you are and where you grew up. I mean, I can certainly, some communities are like, oh, no way. You know, it was a very privileged thing that they were depicting, and others are like, oh, sure, this totally happens at our school. So,
but I heard from a lot of adults as well who were triggered by their own high school memories of just, you know,
I was completely, you know, absolutely.
Yeah, of just that feeling of being on the outside, or people being against you, or who you were going to stand with in the halls. I mean, it was a lot of
that
universal
paranoia
themes.
Right.
Yeah, for sure.
But with privilege, though, I was just going to say, you know, we may think that in affluent areas that these things don't go on, but I can certainly say they do. It's, again, things that aren't necessarily talked about. And it's not just them not talking about it, it's then if they do talk about it, who do they talk to? And that's where counselors and, you know, Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, all different helplines, etc., we hear far more about what truly goes on. And I thought that those things were quite well depicted. There were certainly some things around stalking that wasn't accurate. There were some key, you know, areas that I felt they could have done with some further experts to help them depict. And I felt that it could be, you know, some of the stereotypes around stalking, for example, were particularly unhelpful. But in terms of what she was having to deal with and the impact of one thing after the other, and that sense of her character sort of, you know, being eroded, and her self-esteem and sort of the leap into depression was quite well done, or the gradual, I should say, grinding down of her.
Yeah, I would say so. I would have loved somewhere to be some kind of hope in there. I mean, that's, again, I've said that before. I would have loved to see, you know, because I do think you did see her demise, and you saw, like, just being failed every step of the way, that there was no, you know, maybe there had been a presentation in one of her classes. You know, again, going to that posters after the fact. Maybe if there had been a poster in one of her classes, she might have seen it and thought, okay, I don't have to suffer in silence. Maybe I'll reach out.
So that she wouldn't have actually killed herself in the end.
Right.
Is that what you're saying?
That could have gone a different way.
That can be people's experience, can't it? I mean, you know, we do have clients like that, and it's just one thing is compounded by another and by another, and you think that it's not possible for all those things to happen. But isn't that also, I understand what you're saying about the hope, but I actually think that makes people think even more. And, in terms of the impact that you can have on someone, it's the small things. And if you just take that 1 second to ask the question, or to help someone, or to be mindful and be compassionate and have empathy, you know, for me, when I felt, you know, particularly overwhelmed at times, it's the kindness of strangers, more often than not, that have made the biggest difference to buoying me up. And I think they're the things that are, you know, perhaps that is well done, because it makes us all think that we could do something different and transform and change, you know, somebody's journey, if you like.
Well, I think the hopeful, for me, at least the hopeful message is at the end, you know, the kids who drive off together and they've all come clean and people have acknowledged what they could have done differently and what, and they understand now what was going through her head. So in that sense, that the learning, Laura is always saying, you know, what do we learn from it?
Right.
I think that is hopeful. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I understand it's, and I wonder if today, you know, we're looking at kids are so savvy and they grow up so fast that if something is has too much of a Disney ending, they sort of tune out. It's like, well, that's not realistic because everybody in this room has been touched by suicide. So, you know, but I understand completely that.
But I think it's important to note that adolescent psychological development is such that it's almost a universal experience that teens feel isolated. They feel like they are not. Their bodies are changing. Their emotions are raging. They have all sorts of things going on that are new and different, and they're trying to fit in at the same time as they're trying to be individuals. And what that does is leave them with a feeling like they don't rate. They're not cool. They don't have the, you know, all the friends that they should have, and any little things that put a chink in that very weak armor can become devastating. I think it's important to note that you literally are not alone, because you are an adolescent. You're developing, and these are things that naturally occur over the course of these years in your life. But they get better. They get better, and you can have a wonderful life. And no matter how many times that you feel like you were kicked when you were down, you actually can get up, dust yourself off, and still have a wonderful life. And that's an important thing for everybody to know.
Right. And one of the things, I mean, that they, when you talk about suicide, is talking about messages of hope of people who've gone through it and come out on the other side. And I think that is, I mean, if you go on our website, we have a suicide prevention video in which it shows a parent who's lost a child to suicide and their experience. And she goes forward and talks to other kids about what the experience has been like in hopes it triggers them. I don't want this to be my mom. And there's also kids on there who've struggled but gotten better and gotten help.
Right.
And I think that is the important message. It's important for adults to also think, I mean, we think our kids fight with a friend is, oh, they just had a fight with a friend. It's not the end of the world. To them, it may be.
Yeah. So. But, you know, I want to give a message of hope. And a friend of mine, a very dear friend of mine, his name is Taps Mugadza, and he was abandoned in an orphanage in Zimbabwe, Harare, Zimbabwe, the poorest city in the poorest country on the planet at the time. And yet he speaks in such a positive, uplifting way. He sings. He's got an amazing voice. But he went through terrible things as a child and didn't even speak outside the orphanage till he was 15. He was so afraid of people. But if you go on YouTube and go to Taps, My Journey, T-A-P-S, My Journey, you'll hear his message of hope. And then you can listen to some of his songs. And it's amazing. You know, he sings about pain and suffering, but he also sings about overcoming them. He sings about, you know, the joy he has in life. And it's an amazing thing to see somebody who has gone through so much and had nothing, absolutely nothing in his life, but he still managed to come through. And he has a great life now.
Right. So it's amazing. Yeah. And I think that's been one of our campaigns after the suicide is your ending doesn't have to be Hannah's. Your story doesn't have to be. You can be going through the same things as Hannah. You can struggle, but you don't have to end that same way.
You can be going through worse than what she went through and still have a wonderful life.
Right.
We're everybody at this table is a living example that you can get through this time in your life and horrible things can happen to you, but you can actually still live and love and enjoy life and do some amazing things.
Well, as we wrap up, because I know you have to be somewhere, Cheryl. Laura, do you want to say anything before we wrap up?
No, I think the message has to be one of hope, doesn't it? Of, you know, that focus on prevention, and you can turn things around, as Jim said. And what I think, you know, again, the victim's voice, certainly Hannah's voice, was very much at the center of that. And when people speak out, we've got to listen. And, you know, the act of listening as well as asking the right questions is just so important. And learning the lessons from all these things and through media depictions and from helplines that you run, Cheryl, you know, of how to have those questions as well. Raising awareness is just so important. So thank you for the life-saving work that you do.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. It's great to meet you all.
And I did find the campaign that Cheryl mentioned that is in the UK. It's called Grassroots Suicide Prevention. And the campaign is called All Right, Mate. which I think is so appropriate, Laura.
Yes,
I know.
Absolutely.
So if you go to prevent-suicide.org.uk, you can find that, or just Google "All Right, Mate," and you will find that resource. So once again, do you want to tell us the teen line number and website?
Yeah, so our teen line website, definitely. I mean, if you're listening today and you're a teen and you just want to talk, I mean, whether it's about suicide or anything, please reach out to talk. Website is www.teenlineonline.org. And our phone number is 310-855-4673, again, between 6 and 10 p.m. California time. National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-8255, and they're there 24/7, 365, different languages as well. So,
yeah. Amazing. Amazing.
Well, we really want to thank you for coming, Cheryl, and this has been a very informative discussion, and I'm hoping that people out there who are listening feel better about their situations and feel empowered to talk to their family and friends, and even somebody they don't know that well, if they see signs that they might be depressed or isolated, that they reach out to them and give them some support and hope. Hope is going to prevent suicide. Thank you very much. Signing off for Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things that you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcast and leave us a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotion and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go over to Facebook and like our Facebook page. And one last thing is please tell all your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening to us. We really appreciate you.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline, free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website www.genesisshelter.org or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.